I'll tell you what, these first 3 hours with David Politis have flown by. We're not even scratching the surface. Still have the rest of the country still to cover, and we'll try to get to as much of it as we can. But of course, there's an obvious omission here tonight. Who or what is doing this? Wolves, bears, cults, illegal aliens, drug farmers, actual aliens, Bigfoot, the books, and from our conversation tonight so far, pointedly, do not speculate on what might be behind all these spooky and strange cases. Why not? We'll see if we can get David to open up a little bit of that and cover as much of the rest of the country as we can, and then open up the phone lines with a few questions from you. Lots more to come here in this final hour on Coast to Coast AM. David, could you finish up the story you were telling about the one disappearance in Yosemite and then briefly touch on another weird case there, Evelyn Roseman?
Yeah, I was going right into Roseman, and so she disappeared in October of '68. She was from San Francisco, and she was visiting with some friends. She liked to hike. She went out for a hike one day on October 19th, and she didn't come back. And what happened was this Butch Farabee, who wrote about this case extensively, had a lot more insight into it than is publicly available. And what he talked about was that Evelyn was found at the base of Nevada Falls. And that in and of itself wouldn't have been unusual, except that in Butch's book, he states that she was launched from the top of the falls to where brain matter was found on boulders near the Merced River. So what that meant was is that by falling, she couldn't have reached the location where her body was found, and somehow or another, she was projected out so far that it was unreasonable to assume that fall could have come accidentally. And by launching it, it was hard for him to understand how a human could have launched something that far. And what it took hours for them to figure out what happened, because after she fell or was launched, and after she hit the bottom, somebody or something took her and drug her a long distance away, 200-300 yards, and then lifted her shirt and caused extreme dry lacerations in her vaginal area, meaning she was raped. Now, one of the interesting things about this was that there was never any flyers put out in the park of any danger about this. Obviously, this is still an open case, and they wouldn't comply with FOIA and release it. It's still under investigation. But this occurred in '68, and there's never been any real progress on the case, and there are no suspects to the best that Butch or anyone else knew. This is an isolated case like this as far as anyone knows, but again, because they don't put out any data, it's hard to tell what's how far reaching this is.
I don't know if you know the answer to this, but was there, the scratches you talked about, was there any kind of other bodily fluids that would give them a clue about DNA?
Well, in '68, I'm sure that all they could do was blood type it back then.
Right.
And nowadays, I'm sure if they had some, with the DNA in California, the DNA data bank, that they probably should run it. But I'm not even sure if they even have the evidence anymore.
Yeah, like homicide cases. I know the homicide detectives here have kept DNA from cases way, way back. I don't know about '60s, but certainly into the '70s. And although they didn't have the ability to test it then, they could test it now if somebody saved it.
Absolutely.
Back to, you had already told us at the beginning of the show about the attitude of the Park Service, particularly hostile there in Yosemite. A couple of folks have emailed me after hearing you and said, well, look, the Park Service is posting things online about disappearances. There's one case in particular from September about a guy who disappeared. Therefore, they must be cooperative, and you must be exaggerating the lack of cooperation. Have you seen it? Did they have a website that is putting incidents on the website? Is that a new development for them?
So what they do is, it's almost, I suppose they're penned into it. At the time that somebody disappears, they have to put it out. There's an individual that's on our website named George Pinka who disappeared with a group. And it's a pretty unusual event in itself. He's with a church group. He was near the back of the group, as is normal, and he disappeared. We asked Yosemite for FOIA on that. They denied it, of course. And, yeah, of course, it's put out at the time the person disappears. And then you watch, as time goes on, you will never hear another thing about it.
Hmm.
And this is so common with disappearances inside the park system. And there's no reason, I mean, there's no reason for me to exaggerate anything. I don't have a bone to pick with them. The truth is stranger than any fiction I could make up. Come on, how many agencies in law enforcement are there in the world that don't have statistics, lists, locations of missing people?
I wouldn't be surprised that they keep lists of missing animals in some of these parks. You know,
yeah.
Five moose disappeared or something like that, but don't have it for, pointedly, don't have it for people. David, I mentioned in the sort of in the break that we're sort of dancing around discussing who's behind it. And you do that in the books, I guess, on purpose. You don't speculate about it. My guess is that maybe you started this work chasing down what kinds of files the government might have about Bigfoot, Sasquatch, things of that sort. Is there a reason you don't want to speculate? I guess, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it could be that you just don't know.
So I've written a couple books about Bigfoot, and in some circles, some people would think maybe I have more knowledge than others on in a certain realm of Bigfoot. But I'm also one of these kind of guys that has a pretty wide breadth of things. I do a lot of reading. I look into a lot of unusual events. And just like you know a lot about the UFO world and Area 51, George, and I've read a lot of books about abductions and John Mack and the abductee phenomena. And you start to think, well, these young kids are disappearing. And I asked some DNA experts, when's our DNA at the optimum? And it's that under 10 region where our DNA really doesn't change much, and it's at that purest state. Well, then you start to look at an area like Pennsylvania, and we didn't get into this, but we can talk about it another time, where the majority of the disappearances were young kids across an entire state in the 40s and 50s, and then it stopped. Well, that doesn't make any sense. You know, during a certain span of time, this age group disappears. And I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but asking about DNA in this age group, some of these, in fact, a majority of these kids eventually made it back. Most of them couldn't say what happened. But again, they have these scratches all over them. If there was some work being done on them, we'd never know because sometimes they're so scratched up, nobody knows.
Were any of the kids in the Pennsylvania cases able to say anything?
Some of the kids said some pretty strange things. There were a couple of cases where they said that they were taken by a bear, and the bear cuddled with them all night, and the bear left, and they left. And this happened more than once. And, I mean, I've talked to bear experts all over America, and they said that it's not going to happen. Come on. You know, if a bear rarely is even going to approach you. A bear may approach a child, and if it approaches the child, and if it's really, really, really hungry, maybe there's going to be an attack, but it's not going to cuddle with something all night.
You're not what I wonder is how big this really could be. It's hard enough for you to get anything out of these agencies, a blood from a stone. How many cases there really may be, not only in national parks, but in the files of some other agencies, and they don't even make the connection. It also makes me wonder whether it could be happening in urban areas. If whatever's behind this is able to snatch somebody with their parents just a few feet away, they could be doing this in urban areas, and maybe it doesn't get the same kind of attention as someone disappearing in the wilderness. There's no big search party that goes out, but it could be happening under people's noses, and no one is even putting it together.
Again, that window of opportunity is so small in many of these cases that it defies common sense that it's just an accidental occurrence. And in many, many of the cases, you will read in the articles where the parents and neighbors say, this has to be an abduction. The person had to have been kidnapped. And law enforcement says, no, no, no. And then when the child is found and at a location that doesn't make any sense, law enforcement will sometimes say, you know, it's a possibility. And especially when the person shows up at a location that's been searched five times or is on a path where they search all the time. Another common theme is that when the victim is, so the victim disappears, immediately after the disappearance, it storms. Again, a common theme. Right after they disappear, it rains really hard. It snows or whatever. Days later, the victim is found in the clothing they were wearing sometimes, but the clothing is dry, it's clean, and their hair is clean, and there's no way they could have been outdoors. And that happened many, many times. And that's when the searchers and law enforcement start to say, you know, maybe there was something odd here. Maybe they were abducted and then dropped in a field in the middle of the corn. That's what the result was. They were found in a field in a giant cornfield. Or they were found in a giant pig pen in clean clothes, but mud all around them, and they were dry.
Of course, it sounds like you are open to the possibility that there's some sort of a paranormal explanation. One of the strangest centers of paranormal activity anywhere in the world is a place that I've written about, the Uinta Basin. And that's one of the clusters you found is in the Uinta Mountains there. Can you give me a thumbnail sketch of the kinds of things that happened there?
So first of all, for people that know, the area specifically that I write about is very high up in elevation. There isn't, it's above timberline. There aren't a lot of trees. There's a lot of water and a lot of lakes. And there's a couple incidents, and there are many incidents that I write about, where a child disappears while they're at a summer camp with a group of kids or in a group setting with a lot of kids. The case I write extensively about that is a case called Garrett Bardsley. And Garrett was a kid that was with a Boy Scout group. And his dad went with the group. And they he was 12 years old, happened in August of 2004. They walked a short distance away from camp, and they went fishing in one of the lakes. Short time after Garrett was with his dad, he slightly fell in the water, and he got wet. And he told his dad he was going to walk back to camp and change. And his dad could watch him almost the entire distance until he hit a tree line between themselves and the camp. He went into the tree line. His dad fished, waited another 10 minutes. Garrett didn't come back. He started to look for him. Then went back to the camp. Nobody saw him. A giant search ensues. And the only thing they found is they found one of his socks in a boulder field up above where he disappeared. Two things about that are fascinating to me because of all the cases I've read. People disappear in boulder fields. I have no idea why. I have no idea what the assimilation may be. Second reason is that footwear and socks tend to come off when these kids disappear. Again, I don't know why. Doesn't make any sense. But that sock was up above where he disappeared, and that doesn't make any sense because the path was obvious on where he was walking back to. There is no way he could have detoured and gotten lost.
You mentioned Yosemite, of course. What about Yellowstone?
Very, very interesting case there. A kid named Dennis Johnson. The Johnson family was on vacation. They pulled into an outlet to picnic. The dad told Dennis and his sister, why don't you go out and look for squirrels and some acorns and come on back when you're done, but we'll get everything set up and you guys just go have fun. So Dennis and his sister take off, and after a short distance, they separate. And the daughter, which is kind of, this happened in 66, the daughter is the first one that disappears. And Dennis starts looking for her and comes back to his dad. He was only 8 years old, and the daughter was, I think, 9 or 10. Dennis comes back to his dad and says, hey, I can't find my sister. Let's start looking. So Dennis and his dad start looking, and Dennis disappears unbeknownst to his dad. His dad, they split up. His dad comes back to the picnic area, and a ranger drives back in a car and says, are you missing a daughter? He says, yeah. Well, at a campsite at 2 miles away, a girl walked up, and we have her. And he goes, well, that's great, but now my son's missing. So, again, that happened in July of 66. Dennis was 8 years old. And they searched for Dennis for weeks, and they never found him. What's unusual about that event is that about 3 miles from the site where Dennis disappeared, we did get the FOIA on this. And in the reports, it said that they found some kind of shelter area where something large was sleeping under. And they didn't call it a den. They called it a shelter area. That's the second time I've heard that wording used on the disappearance of a young boy. That happened also in Crater Lake, where they found a shelter area up above where another boy disappeared with his dad. Now, Dennis Johnson has, and Dennis Martin, who disappeared from Great Smoky Mountains, I don't put a lot into disappearances and things and familiarities, but I gotta say that I wrote about this and it bothered me. So Dennis Johnson and Dennis Martin were both, Dennis Johnson was 8, Dennis Martin was 6. And Dennis Johnson's dad's name was William, and Dennis Martin's dad's name was William. And they both disappeared in a national park wearing a red shirt, and they both disappeared within years of each other. And I wrote about that in the book because, again, it's not that frequent that kids disappear and are never found. But both these Dennises disappeared, and they were never found. And the report specifically indicated that William Johnson and William Martin waited at that park long after the search was over, searching for their boys. And they waited for weeks afterwards looking for more help and looking for answers and never got it. If these two men could have met each other, I'm sure they were duplicates of each other with the way they looked for their boys. And I should say that I had the opportunity to interview Mr. Martin, Dennis Martin, who disappeared in the Great Smokies. He won't talk to the press. And I didn't call beforehand, but I walked up to his house, and he lives in Knoxville. This happened in the 60s, and I knocked on the door with another researcher, and he and I he came out to the front porch. I told him who I was and what I was there for, and he says, you know, I haven't talked about this event in years. Right away, he got tears in his eyes. He says, I haven't talked about this in years, and my wife and I have lived with this for a lifetime, and it's almost ruined us as people, and I just don't want to dwell on it anymore. And I told him, I said, hey, I came all the way from California to talk to you. And if I could just get a couple of answers to a couple of questions, I'd be eternally grateful.
We'll have to save those answers until after the break. And I think the audience would cut my head off if I don't open up the phone lines for at least a couple of questions, which is what we will do after this break. Continue our conversation about missing 411 with author David Politis. A lot of emails from listeners who tell me that they're going to have trouble sleeping tonight and are going to have a real whole lot of trouble talking their family into going camping anytime soon. We're just barely scratching the surface. Arizona has a couple of clusters, including one case that's mentioned in David's book about a park ranger, National Park Service ranger, who disappeared, setting off a massive manhunt. One of the strangest cases, a lot in New Mexico, several in Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and Idaho, and that's just the western U.S. We haven't even touched on the eastern U.S. David mentions in the book he left out Florida and Texas on purpose because there's so many cases in those two states alone that he'd need another entire volume, so maybe we can talk him into writing another book on it. We're opening up the phone lines with your questions. Try to get to as many as we can right after this on Coast to Coast AM. It is our final segment with David Politis. This program has just flown by. A lot of folks on the phones. I'll just ask you, callers, please get right to your point so we can get to as many as we can. East of the Rockies, Glenn in Texas. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, George. David, A-plus on this show. Fascinating stuff.
Thank you.
I think I've nailed it. About 80% or so of the incidences have taken place in the range or former range or newly acquired range of one of the most insatiably curious, insatiably hungry, and almost a super animal here in America that most people probably aren't aware of. our great grandparents had bounties on them, and the Native Americans or the Stone Age people here in North America referred to them as devils, and that would be the Wolverine. These things actually run up and down mountains looking for winter kill during the winter. They don't hibernate. They eat everything right down to the teeth, and I'm not saying they're responsible for predation. In some cases, it may be, but surely scavenging, and would they're a member of the weasel family, and any buttons, zippers, shoelaces would be a problem that would have to be solved. What do y'all think,
Dave?
Well, I'm sure that it's possible, and again, I'm open to all these things. I don't have a closed mind about any part of this. That some of those bones could have been gnawed down to small pieces by animals, absolutely. But when you look at the entirety of the scene, some of the areas, there's belt buckles that are rolled up, pants that are inside out. It doesn't add up to anything that a small animal could do. But your point about the small bones has possibilities, of course.
I'm not sure how a Wolverine would pick up a kid and transport it 12 miles as well. Glenn, thank you for the call. West of the Rockies, we have a call from Central Idaho. I don't have the name there, but James. Good morning, James. How you doing?
Good, George. Hi, Dave. Hello. I would say half to two-thirds of those cases were mountain lions. I've seen mountain lions in action, and they're pretty awesome. I was out antler hunting one time here about a half mile from the house. I'm in the steep mountains of Idaho. Anyway, I caught sight of an elk, and I was kind of watching her. She was a big cow. She probably weighed 450 pounds or better, real healthy. And all of a sudden, I saw a blur, and it was a mountain lion. It jumped on that cow, and I thought, boy, I'm going to see a hell of a battle here. And I was wishing I had a video camera, but I didn't. Anyway, I had my binoculars on it, and this thing jumped on that cow, broke its neck. The cow didn't even move, didn't have a chance to move. And it laid there for about a minute and a half, then it got up on top of the cow and licked its face off, just like a house cat does, you know. And, boy, I wish I'd had a camera. But anyway, I'm sitting there watching it, amazed, and then it grabbed that thing by the neck. This was a female mountain lion, about 140 pounds at the most. And it drug it uphill, all a slight incline, maybe 10 degrees in the snow. And then it, you know, 20, 30 yards, maybe 20 yards. Then it stopped, took a break, did it again, and then took another break, and then dragged it uphill again about 20 yards.
I wonder if it left blood then.
Well, I couldn't tell. And I was running out of daylight, so I had to get off the mountain and get back home. And I decided I'd go back the next day and pull the ivories. You know, elk have a ivory that people around here prize as a trophy, you might say. I went back over there, and I figured I was within 50 yards of where that cat. See, they bury their dead, their kills, and save them for later. I guess they age them. I don't know. But anyway, I'm about 50 yards from where I figured she'd buried that first elk. And crash, bang, boom, here comes a... And this is down in the bottom of a gully. To start with, I was on a ridge the first day. Anyway, this bull elk, he was a four-point on each side. He had one horn busted off from a previous battle, I guess. But anyway, he crashes down the hill and lands about 20 yards from me. And, of course, that made the hair on my neck stand up because I thought the cat was right there. It was in a big pile of brush. And finally, I walked over there to that elk. And I actually pulled him up on his feet, and he was kind of weak because it was into winter about this time of year. And he stood there. I went, got about 50 yards back away and smoked a couple cigarettes and watched him. He was so weak and shaking, he couldn't move. And I know that cat came back and got it. Well, I walked out of that drainage, and I counted 10 dead elk, and I did see one of the kittens. That's how come I know it was a... And there was kitten tracks all over. That's how I know it was a female.
Okay, James, let's let Dave jump into this conversation.
Sure. So there were many cases that we reviewed where the possibility that a mountain lion or a cougar could have been involved, and we eliminated them. And you got to remember that when somebody disappears, that's seen originally, by most accounts, is handled as a crime scene when it first occurs, because they really don't know. And so what they're looking for is they're looking for a struggle in the ground. They're looking for tracks. They're looking for indications, first of all, of animal, bear, mountain lion, whatever. None of these cases had that. And if they're, just like George said, well, would there be blood? There would be blood. There would probably be hair. There would be noise. There would be sound. There would be, things would be flown around. And when they come in with the bloodhounds and the canines, they bring in different types. They bring in some for animals. They bring in some for humans. They bring in some for dead bodies. And as we all know who are outdoorsmen, hey, some of those canines are excellent at chasing down a cougar, chasing down a bear. So I believe that in some of the incidents, possibly a cougar or mountain lion could be involved. But in those instances, we excluded the case.
Thank you, James. Appreciate it. First-time caller Bob in San Diego. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. I'll get right to the point. You know, you had somebody on there talking a few weeks ago, David Wilcox, and he has a new book out, and it's called The Source Field Investigations. And in this book on Chapter 17, there's that chapter pretty much deals with this stuff here, it's what you're talking about. And the name of the chapter is Time Slips, Time Warps, and Vortex Phenomenon. And they're talking, and this one I was just reading, this little kid disappeared for a little bit, and he came back, but he was in a time warp. I don't know if you ever read that or took that into consideration, but it could be an answer to it. I'll let you go and take the answer off the air. Thanks.
Well, thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. I mean, you're open to that idea, right, David? Without even spelling it out in the book, you're open to that possibility that it's some sort of a dimensional thing.
Absolutely, it could be.
In the ranch in Utah that we've looked at, some strange creatures that seem to slip in and out of our reality, at least according to witness reports, and those kind of things have been reported all over. I know it gets into some real high strangeness kind of stuff, but when you have a mystery of this sort, I think it's required to keep an open mind.
Well, one of the things I write about extensively is that once a researcher closes their mind off, they might as well not be called a researcher anymore. They're going after their own hypothesis, and they've closed everything else off. And there's a lot of that going on in the world, but I like to think of myself as one of those people that's open to different ideas. I know as a police investigator, the proper track to take to eliminate things, but the breadth of what the possibilities may be are so extensive that I really don't close much off.
You know, of course, you have a certain fondness for Sasquatch, Bigfoot. You've been chasing that mystery for a long time. I suppose there's got to be some kind of concern that if it turns out that Bigfoot was involved in any of this, according to witnesses, or something like Bigfoot, you'd have to worry about people going out there and hunting it more than they're already hunting it.
Well, we'll go over to the Bigfoot side of the fence for a second. I mean, people have been hunting Bigfoot for years. Who's been successful?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Talk about the ranch. And the farmer, that how many times has he shot things? They could never bring anything down permanently, right?
Yeah, it's true. They'd shoot something and poof, it would disappear.
All right.
Back to the phones. Andrew in Los Angeles on the Wild Card Line. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. Great show, George. And I think your guest, Dave, is sharp enough to eventually unravel the mystery. I have a real quick question. Do you know if any reports of missing children or adults, mysterious disappearances have occurred in the Flagstaff, Arizona National Forest area? And have there also been any reports in other countries in forested areas where there's a similar pattern? And also the federal silence is very suspect. And I believe there's a connection to the silence and the possible answers that you are seeking. And thank you very much for your
Thanks.
Information.
Okay. Flagstaff area, David?
So nothing comes out of me right away with that Flagstaff area. There's a region just north and east of Phoenix and an area east of Tucson. But again, it's hard to get a lot of data. And I'm not saying that nothing has happened in Flagstaff, but nothing comes out at me right now, and I didn't write about anything there, but sometimes these cases, one will pop up in the middle of nowhere every once in a while that fits the parameters that I'm looking at. And right now, nothing I remember in Flagstaff. Now, the question about the other country is a great question. And not too long ago, a couple months ago, we were reading some articles out of Australia, and I don't remember, it was a Boulder Hill area or a giant mountain of rocks where a series of people disappeared under very similar circumstances. And I didn't even want to get into it because it boggles my mind with what I'm working with right now. But that's a great question, and maybe that's the next way to go.
We'll go to our wildcard line in West Texas. Lynn in West Texas, how you doing?
I'm good. How are y'all this morning?
All right.
Good. George, first I want to tell you I appreciate how you comment on your music.
Well, thank you.
I really enjoy that. I not only enjoy the music you pick very much, but I really like the way you comment on it. I heard you make a comment that you left out Texas and Florida. Are you saying you left those out just because of the size of the states, and I'm particularly interested in the Big Bend National Park?
So Florida and Texas have a lot of unusual disappearances. And I put in my book that I could probably write a book about each location, each state.
Anything come to mind about, is it Big Bend that you mentioned?
Yes, Big Bend. Is there, in your opinion, a reason other than just the size of these states why there are so many incidences?
So in the eastern version of the book, I write that there's a lot of parallels between missing people and water, and specifically swampy areas. And kids are found in the middle of swamps, around swamps, in areas where you and I wouldn't go, and kids probably wouldn't go themselves voluntarily. And if you keep in mind those swampy areas, it seems that a lot of these missing cases go with it. Now, we did take a hard look at Louisiana and Mississippi, and there's none there. So that's a bit baffling. And there is one right on the Georgia border with Alabama, a cluster. But going north up the Appalachian Mountains, it just is thick.
Thank you, Lynn. Appreciate it. David in Lake Tahoe. David, how you doing?
George and David, awesome show. I'll get right to my point. I've been to a lot of the places that you've mentioned tonight, David. I've been to Yellowstone a couple times. I just did Yosemite two times in this past last summer and fall. And I hike all around the Lake Tahoe area, and I live for the outdoors and the wilderness. And I would say, from my experience, the wild animals do not attack people. I've seen many bear. I've seen a few mountain lion. I've seen wolves. And they're not out there just hunting people. They're pretty much stay away. And just as you would keep your children close by when you go to the shopping mall, I would never, as much as I do this, I would never enter the wilderness and the woods without my dog and my weapons and respect the forest. I mean, you have to respect the possibility of all those things that could happen, and I don't think it has much to do or anything with wild animals because they seem to fear us more than we do them.
You know, David makes a good point, Dave, about the being careful when you're out in areas like this. I guess what advice would you give to folks, parents of small kids? You got to hold on to them, keep an eye on them.
Well, I'll tell you what, I think his points are right on target. And after doing this, I guarantee I look at the woods an entirely different way. Many of the kids who disappeared on a trail and got just out of sight from their parents in a very short period of time. My statement is that no more than 6 feet, always in view, and I don't point a finger to these parents because I know I raised two kids, and when we were in the woods, we were careful, but there's also that freedom that you're in the woods and you're having fun, and even I'd always carry a gun, but still, the whole paradigm about being in a national forest or a park changes for me, and it's not for the good.
I want to thank all of our callers. We've only got a short time left, so I'm going to steal the time back. Any plans on doing a book about Texas and Florida, a third version of this?
I don't think so. If anything, I think maybe more in detail going north up into Canada. But again, this is something that's evolving as more and more details come in. And I know that there's more clusters out there that I just haven't been able to figure out because I don't have the data yet. But hopefully, you know, with everyone's help and continuing to sift through the archives, it'll start to make more sense.
One other quick question. It's about the last time you were here, we were talking about an effort to isolate DNA samples at reported Bigfoot sighting places. Any information you give us on where that stands?
I can tell that it's been a monumental effort. I think right now we probably have over 150 different samples from across the U.S. We've been able to get mitochondrial and nuclear DNA, which is a huge step forward. And the effort is, I would say, at the 11th hour now, and we should be on the verge of something big very, very quickly.
Well, I hope you'll come back and share us with us that information when the time is right. I know there have been various leaks, a lot of speculation online about it, a lot of misinformation about it as well, and I hope that hasn't caused too much damage to the research effort.
I hope not. I wouldn't believe 99% of what you read out there.
Well, that's true for no matter what the topic is. The book is Missing 411. There are two versions of it, the Western U.S. and Canada and the Eastern U.S. My guest, David Politis, done an excellent job with it. It is a heck of a read, and I think it's the kind of thing, once you read it, you never forget it. David, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks a million, George, for the time.
Keep us in the loop. Thank you, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks as well to all my folks there at Premier for helping me through the program, Tim and Gary and the call screener. Jason, I almost forgot your name there. And good night, everyone. I'll be back next month.